Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
You know, I want you to imagine for a second that you're just standing in your kitchen. It's late at night, and you are wearing a very, very stained bathrobe.
Okay, well, not exactly the most glamorous starting point for a story.
No, far from it.
Yeah.
And you're holding this broken appliance, right? And it's actively leaking some sort of, like, unidentifiable sticky fluid onto your linoleum floor.
Oh, gross.
Right. But right in that specific moment, the doorbell rings, and someone is standing there, and they just hand you a Grammy.
Mm.
Or, like, an Oscar.
Wait, really? Just right there in the kitchen?
Right there. It's this massive, shining symbol of, you know, prestigious industry validation.
Yeah, a symbol that just completely clashes with the entire domestic disaster you're literally standing in the middle of.
Exactly. And that incredibly jarring collision, you know, between high-tier industry recognition and just raw, unvarnished biological reality. That is the exact time capsule we were opening for you today. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. Today, our mission is to take a deep dive into the source material from November 2009.
Oh, yeah, specifically in the Big Fatty Online, or, you know, the BFO universe.
Right. We are looking at this month where the messy, unfiltered reality of just pure domestic chaos kind of collides head-on with an unexpected and honestly almost hilarious wave of global digital prestige.
Yeah, I mean, November 2009 is really a month of profound whiplash because you have these deep physical losses and incredibly grounded life philosophies, right?
Yeah.
But then they're sitting right next to, like, exploding glitter cards and literal podcasting warfare.
It's wild. But let's start right in the mud, I think, because November 2009 kicks off with the host in just a state of complete physical ruin.
Oh, absolutely. We open the month with him recovering from an intensely overindulgent Friday night.
Yeah, and the details he shares here are really what make this archive so vivid. He tells the audience he was, quote, all drunk up.
All drunk up on his gin of choice, which is so specific.
Right, which he explicitly mispronounces in that signature Southern drawl of his as Tanqueray 10s instead of Tanqueray, no.
Tanqueray 10s, I love that. And wait, he mixed it with something highly specific too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He mixed it with homemade tonic water that he carbonated himself in a soda stream.
See that juxtaposition right there? You've got a raging bender, but it's fueled by a suburban kitchen gadget like a soda stream.
Right.
It just perfectly encapsulates his specific brand of domestic hedonism. Like, he isn't out at some VIP club. He is getting aggressively overserved just using a countertop appliance.
Yeah, no, totally. And it derails his entire weekend. So he passes out in what he affectionately calls the love chamber, which is
the bedroom inside the fat cave, right?
Exactly. And by passing out, he completely misses the highly anticipated gay Christmas Halloween festivities that are happening out in the real world.
Right. So instead of being out at the bar in a costume, having a great time, he wakes up incredibly hungover.
Oh, the worst hangover.
And he turns on the television and he spends his entire Saturday just watching a televised rodeo.
But, like, he isn't just passively watching it. He zeroes in on the most grotesque elements possible.
Of course he does.
He actually gets on the microphone and tells thousands of people that he was sitting there watching these bulls buck, and he was fixated almost entirely on the, quote, bull snot flying out of their noses.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That is the baseline we are starting from. Bull snot and soda stream gin.
Well, you know, that solitary weekend is really just the preamble to a much deeper sense of isolation for him.
Oh, so?
Because we have to look at the broader ecosystem of what is actually happening locally to understand what he's missing out on.
Right.
Like, the community is getting all these quirky updates from the auxiliary rat giving the Kakalaki Coastal Fairweather report.
Oh, right, yeah, during the big coal miner weekend.
Exactly. So there is this vibrant, eccentric local life happening all around him, but he is largely cut off from it, just sitting at home watching rodeo snot.
Yeah, and then that isolation, it kind of becomes permanent in early November.
Yep.
Like, it is genuine heartbreak.
Yeah, it really is.
He has to announce the permanent closure of his favorite local bar in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes by the URL moniker patrickpubeonline.com.
Right. And we have to remember, this isn't just a business closing. It is the loss of an absolute institution for him.
Yeah. He formally laments losing his favorite bar stool. and he tells the audience that all of his over-serving will now have to permanently relocate to a solitary venue that he just bleakly refers to as the kitchen.
Right, the kitchen. And, you know, the sociology of what he just lost is really critical here.
Or the third place thing, right?
Exactly. So sociologist Ray Oldenburg coined this term, the third place. Your first place is the home.
Okay.
Your second place is work. And the third place is that public social environment where you gather, you build local identity, and you find unstructured community. By losing PatrickPubeOnline.com, he is losing his primary physical third place.
Wait, let me just jump in and question that dynamic for a second. Because, I mean, we are talking about a guy who is a literal pioneer of digital community building, right?
Yeah.
In 2009, he already has listeners mapping themselves all over the globe. They are tuning in every single day. So why is he so fundamentally devastated by the loss of a physical bar stool? Doesn't the sheer scale of his digital space render a local bar somewhat obsolete?
You know, it actually works the other way around.
Really?
Yeah, because the digital space is massive, sure, but it lacks physical friction. When you lose that physical anchor, like the bartender who knows your exact order or the tactile feeling of a specific bar stool, the podcast essentially becomes the only sanctuary left.
Ah, I see.
Right? The microphone replaces the bar stool. The global audience becomes the regulars sitting right next to him.
Oh, wow.
So when your digital community is your only community, all the validations and the rivalries within that space, they escalate dramatically. The digital world has to basically bear the weight of his entire social existence.
That makes total sense. Yeah. And honestly, that escalation brings us perfectly back to the guy in the stained bathrobe holding the Oscar.
Yes, the podcast awards.
Right. Right as he is nursing this awful hangover and mourning his local bar stool, the BFO universe is just hit with a massive shockwave of industry validation.
It's so funny. Big Fatty finds out that his unpolished, entirely unfiltered daily diary has somehow been nominated in the top 10 worldwide for the GBT category.
A category name which he immediately rebrands for his own personal amusement.
Naturally. He gets on the air and informs his audience that GBT actually stands for Gigantic Loose Bouncing Testicles.
I mean, he deflates the prestige of the acronym in like 10 seconds flat.
Exactly. By rebranding it, he leans aggressively into his outsider status. And, you know, the rivalry aspect of this nomination is what really drives the narrative for the whole month.
Yeah, because he's up against these massive, highly produced heavyweight shows, right?
Right. Primarily one called Feast of Fat, or FOF, which is this institutional juggernaut that usually just sweeps the awards.
But see, his favorite part of this nomination isn't even the prospect of beating FOF.
No, not at all.
His absolute favorite part is the psychological damage that this nomination inflicts on his podcasting arch nemesis, Antivera.
Oh my gosh, Antivera's reaction is incredible.
It is the best. Because Antivera has this habit of trying to download his show early. So she listens to his Monday broadcast before it's technically fully released.
Right.
She hears the news that he has been nominated as a top 10 podcast globally.
Right.
And she just breaks down. She sends him an email consisting of pure defeat. It just says, I give up.
And then doesn't she follow it up later with another one?
Yeah. She follows up later with another email that simply says, I got nothing.
That is amazing. And the psychology of his reaction to all this is brilliant.
Yeah. It's like, well, it's like a punk rock band getting nominated for a Grammy.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And they just show up in ripped jeans specifically to revel in how much their presence annoys the pop stars.
Exactly. He is weaponizing his own lack of prestige. And the context of the 2009 podcasting landscape makes this even more significant.
It was all getting very serious then,
yeah,
right?
Totally. Early podcasting was just starting to professionalize. You had creators begging for votes, orchestrating all these PR stunts, and trying to attract corporate sponsors by looking as polished as possible.
And Big Fatty just refuses to play that game entirely.
Exactly. He does not want to win to validate his ego. He wants to win just to playfully torture Antivera and to prove that raw, unedited authenticity can actually disrupt sterile professionalism.
Yeah. And the community, they just instantly mobilize around this whole underdog narrative.
I bet they love it.
We hear this amazing voicemail from a listener named David the Blue Jeans Guy, and he explicitly maps out the stakes. He says a BFO win over the Feast of Fat would be like Truman defeating Dewey.
That is so dramatic.
Right. He says it's the tortoise beating the hare. But my absolute favorite comparison he makes is that it is like rats killing snakes.
Rats killing snakes. That is such a visceral image of an uprising.
It really is.
The audience is not just voting for a podcast. They're voting for a literal rebellion against the establishment. They are voting to prove that their messy corner of the internet holds way more power than the heavily funded studios.
Yeah, but, you know, a rebellion built entirely on jokes and anti-establishment sentiment, it eventually kind of runs out of steam, right?
Sure.
Like, if the show was only about mocking Auntie Vera and talking about hangovers, people wouldn't stick around for decades.
No, they definitely wouldn't.
So the true secret to his extreme audience retention emerges right in the middle of this month when he executes this razor-sharp pivot from absurd comedy to just profound, hard-hitting life philosophy.
Yes, the transition into what the audience calls the wise old owl persona. It is a stunning tonal shift.
Yeah, what does he talk about?
Well, he gets on his soapbox and he targets this pervasive myth in his community, the idea of gay death at age 30.
Ah, right. This cultural anxiety that youth is like the only valuable currency, and aging just means becoming entirely invisible.
Exactly. And he dismantles it by exposing his own vulnerabilities, which is rare. He admits that his early 30s were actually a tough, really dark time.
Yeah, he describes going out to these crowded bars and just feeling completely invisible.
Right.
Having this toxic mindset where he would look around a room of hundreds of people and focus entirely on the fact that no one was interested in him.
And he breaks down the reality of aging with just this unvarnished wisdom. He says, you get through that phase, and when you hit 40, you suddenly get the effits.
Right. You just stop caring what the room thinks.
Exactly. And then he says, when you reach 50, that attitude hardens into armor.
I love that. And he explicitly rejects the societal pressure that a person needs to be, quote, snagged in a romantic relationship to be considered successful or happy.
Yeah, he makes this huge declaration. He says, my friendships are my relationships, completely redefining the hierarchy of human connection for his audience.
Yeah, he insists you have to get out there and actually scrape your knee to learn anything and build that armor.
Let's just pause and analyze the mechanics of this shift for a second. Because delivering a deeply heavy monologue about aging onto an audience that literally just spent the last 2 weeks rallying around gigantic, loose, bouncing testicles and exploding glitter, it is fascinating from a content perspective.
Well, wait, let me challenge you on this
right?
really quick.
Okay.
Because you call it the secret to audience retention. But honestly, shifting from flatulence jokes to a somber lecture on the psychological weight of aging, that sounds like career suicide.
It does on paper.
Yeah. Like in 2009, when audiences were notoriously fickle, how did he not just lose half his subscribers right there? Why didn't they tune out the second the comedy stopped?
Because the internet of 2009 operated very differently than the algorithmic internet of today.
How so?
Well, today, hyper-curated influencers are completely terrified of shifting tone. They pick a lane like comedy, wellness, drama, and they stick to it because the platform punishes inconsistency.
Oh, that's true.
But human beings are inherently inconsistent. So by offering these unpolished, hard-earned truths alongside the comedy, he actually creates a bond that transcends mere entertainment.
Ah, so the audience trusts his advice specifically because he literally just told them about passing out after drinking SodaStream gin.
Exactly. They know he is not selling them a curated lifestyle brand.
Right, yeah.
And he anchors that truth using pop culture in his Memory Lane music segment. He talks about the 1960s sitcom Bewitched.
Oh, yeah. But instead of focusing on the glamorous main characters, he zeroes in on Aunt Clara, played by Marion Lorne.
Yes, which is such a brilliant choice.
He highlights how she has this this weird obsession with collecting doorknobs and how she constantly fumbles her spells.
Right. Her entrances usually consist of her accidentally crashing through walls or coming down the chimney the wrong way.
Yeah, she is the absolute embodiment of imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
But his core point is that despite all of her fumbling, when she is pushed hard enough, she is fiercely loyal. She proves she can be incredibly powerful when it actually counts to defend her family.
So he uses Aunt Clara as a direct metaphor for himself and his audience. You know, you can be a complete mess, you can crash through the walls of your own life, but you still have immense value.
That is so affirming.
It really is. And that affirming message solidifies the loyalty of his listeners right as they head into the most chaotic season of the entire year.
Oh boy. The transition into what he refers to as the crema season.
Yes, crema, which is his proprietary word for the Christmas holiday season.
Right. And looking at the back half of November, we see exactly how those digital friendships actually manifest in the real world.
Because he just gave this incredibly moving speech about how his friends are his relationships.
Yeah. And those highly cherished friends respond to that. as Thanksgiving and Crema approach, with just absolute real-world chaos.
Pure chaos.
Before the mail even hits, Thanksgiving approaches.
Mm.
And he talks about making his Chex potty mix. And he openly debates skipping the traditional labor of cooking a turkey altogether. He tells the audience he might just go to the store, buy pure tryptophan and gin, and just pass out.
I mean, that is definitely one way to celebrate Thanksgiving. And then he also takes his close friend, Miss Kitty, out for a birthday lunch at a place called the Purple Onion.
Yeah, and the culinary details he shares are just so specific to his lexicon. He talks about having cone beef, which is another one of his deliberate, quirky mispronunciations for corned beef cabbage, and a slice of buttermilk pie.
But the real chaos, the true Crema chaos, begins when the physical mail starts arriving.
Oh, yeah.
The digital world just violently bleeds into his living room. He gets this piece of physical mail from a listener known as Stephen the Yuck.
Uh-huh.
It's a build-it-yourself Christmas tree card, but it's rigged.
Rigged? Like a trap?
Yeah. When Big Fatty opens it on the air, it shoots these little paper snowflakes all over his floor.
And Big Fatty affectionately and repeatedly refers to these festive snowflakes simply as S.
Mm, right.
Yes. He's just staring at his floor saying, I've got suffs all over everything.
That is so good. And it doesn't stop there. A listener named Dennis sends him a novelty chocolate mold, explicitly branded as an edible anus.
Oh my gosh.
And then another listener, Bjorn, sends him a massive stack of bacon-flavored envelopes.
Bacon envelopes. I mean, we really should look at why people are mailing him bacon envelopes and anatomical chocolate molds.
Yeah, what is the psychology there?
It seems completely random, but it is actually a highly sophisticated inside language. In the early internet, mailing a physical object that relates to a digital inside joke was basically the ultimate flex.
Right, because it takes actual effort.
Exactly. It required finding the obscure item, paying for real postage, and essentially invading the creator's physical space with an element of the digital culture they built together. It's extremely high effort engagement.
Yeah, and speaking of high effort, another prominent community figure, Kim Beaver, posts this amazing visual gag on her website, The Lodge.
Oh, the beaver picture.
Yes. It is a doctored image of Big Fatty holding a beaver like a hand puppet. And she specifically notes that the beaver looks incredibly dismayed by the entire situation.
See, you have this profound philosophical monologue about friendship from him. And his friends validate that love, not with, like, sappy Hallmark cards, but by mailing him these absolutely absurd items.
Yeah.
This is what a real community looks like. We are so conditioned to think of the holidays as the time for perfect curated greeting cards and flawless family photos, but this community actively rejects that.
They communicate entirely through shared nuisance.
Exactly.
And while all this is happening, he is just casually finalizing his January 2010 travel plans to Washington, D.C., which naturally he refers to as the District of Columbus.
Of course he does. And he keeps the administrative trains running while his living room is literally covered in paper, snowflakes, and bacon envelopes.
It's incredible.
It just proves that the digital bonds they have formed truly thrive on performative nuisance. I mean, you do not send an exploding card to an acquaintance.
No, never.
You only send that to someone you know intimately enough to know they will actually laugh at the mess.
The mess is the message, honestly.
It really is. And, you know, looking at the entirety of November 2009, it offers such a sharp contrast to how we interact today. It leaves you with this important, honestly, slightly unsettling question.
What that?
Well, as the internet becomes increasingly policed by algorithms that punish messy, content-favoring, sterile, brand-safe curation over unpolished reality, are we actually engineering an internet where the kind of deep, lifelong community Big Fatty built is now technologically impossible?
Wow, that is an amazing question to leave hanging in the air for you all.
Mm-hmm.
Are we optimizing away our actual ability to connect through our own flaws?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us at the table today as we unpacked all of this. I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
We invite you to come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination. The early years.
And please remember to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
And explicitly want to remind you to tune in next weekend for the newest episode of Ruination, The Early Years. We'll see you in the mess.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, The Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.